What's black and white and green all over? 50 Shades of Grey, of course, the best-selling and controversial adult novel from E.L. James that's sold over 10 million copies in print and digital since Random House acquired publishing rights from independent publishing startup Writer's Coffee Shop, and it's not even summer reading season yet. In reviews, a blogger takes to audio with a memoir that covers the author's first acid trip and why she mistook her husband's marriage proposal for a murder try. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in CCC's podcast series. My name is Chris Keneally, and every week, Copyright Clearance Center's Beyond the Book speaks with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for an early look at the news the publishers, editors, authors, agents, and librarians will all talk about when they get back to work on Monday. Joining me first on the show from New York City is Andrew Albanese, PW's Features Editor. Andrew, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Greetings, Chris.
Good to have you back. And, the industry, as we follow it every week on this program, has been changing, and change means good news for some and not so good news for others. You've got some of that this week.
Yeah, that's right. So the not so great news we're following here this week is that on May 21st, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Now, on the positive side, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt officials said that filing is going to allow them to restructure their debt and keep operating as usual. But looking at the filings, it is astonishing the amount of debt that has been written off in just the last few years following its acquisition by Riverdeep. And according to the filings, if lenders approve the proposed turnaround plan, and so far it most lenders indicated that they will support that plan, Houghton could be looking at coming back with an initial public offering sometime in 2013. Now, our editorial director, Jim Milliot, has been poring over the numbers, and you know they really are something. For example, when it filed for Chapter 11 this week, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt reported sales, annual sales of about $1.3 billion. And that makes the company roughly the same size as Houghton Mifflin was by itself before it was Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is also before a $4 billion acquisition of Harcourt in 2007. That was supposed to yield a company that was going to have average or annual revenues of $2.5 billion a year. Unfortunately, they're way off their target there. In its filing, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt blamed the recession, subsequent decline in school funding for what it acknowledged as a substantial shortfall in revenue. And of course, the education game has also changed pretty substantially since 2007, especially with the advent of more digital tools. So, you know, we're going to hope for the best for Houghton Mifflin Harcourt as it comes out of this, and we're going to be following the filings very closely.
Right. Well, all sorts of factors, as you point, Andrew, have eaten into the value of HMH there. But on another front, one business's loss is another business's gain, or at least for this quarter.
Well, it's a little bit of good news for Books A Million. Books A Million added over 40 of the former border stores last fall, and that's helped to lift overall sales at the chain by 10.5% for the recently ended first quarter. It still has a net operating loss, but that's also gone down by nearly half. So the chain isn't exactly in a great place yet, but hey, it's better than the alternative. And, you know, it's a place to buy books after Borders' demise. So, you know, we're rooting for them to continue having this good news. And an interesting aspect of the turnaround here has to do with the latest publishing phenomena, as you mentioned in your intro. Books A Million said the improved sales were attributed to the phenomenal success of the 50 Shades of Grey series and also solid sales, continued sales from the Hunger Games. But the success of 50 Shades of Grey is really a sexy publishing story. No, well, I guess pun intended. 6 weeks after Random House took over publication, and it's a trilogy by E.L. James here, the publisher reports that the series has sold over 10 million copies, as you noted, in print and digital. It's gone through 60 printings, and it's captured a whopping 25% of the adult fiction market in recent weeks, which I think is just astounding, especially given that its audience is largely women, and I'm told it's, you know, erotica. I haven't actually read the book, but erotica hasn't always been the most visible thing in most bookstores. Couple of other observations here, as you pointed out, it's not even summer reading season. So, you know, I can only imagine how things will heat up more as the summer kicks off and, you know, the beach reads start coming out. And even my own mother, who came to stay with me a few weeks ago, who has a new Kindle Fire and is reading voraciously on the thing, asked me about this new book, 50 Shades of Grey. to which I put my fingers in my ears and started singing fairy tales.
Well, you know, Andrew, you mentioned about this type of novel, this really truly adult novel of erotica by E.L. James, is not the thing that's been typically visible in the news. And I should tell you that I am going to be moderating a panel that is called You Publish You. It's the day before BEA gets started, and it's all about self-publishing. And we've got Jenny Pedroza, who's one of the trio that founded the Writers Coffee House, which is the early publisher of 50 Shades of Grey. And she made the point with me when I was chatting with her today that what many of the readers like is the fact they can download it to a Kindle or some other tablet, and nobody has to know what they're reading.
And to think, we used to send these things out in brown paper. Now right. We can just download them anonymously.
That's right. Well, you've also got a preview this week for the American Library Association's annual conference.
Yeah, Monday's issue is a packed issue, and it includes our upcoming ALA, our preview of the upcoming ALA annual conference in Anaheim, California. Among the highlights, we look at the authors who are going to be appearing not only on the stages and in the program, but also we offer some picks for authors that are going to be appearing on the show floor or at their publisher booths. And it's a really strong lineup this year at ALA, including John Irving and George R. Martin, among many, many others, hundreds of others. And perhaps the biggest collection of authors is actually going to take place on one stage. This year's ALA ProQuest Scholarship Bash is going to feature the Rock Bottom Remainders. That, of course, is the literary musical supergroup featuring Stephen King, Amy Tan, Mitch Albom, Dave Barry, Matt Groening, Scott Turow. I think Roy Blunt Jr. is going to be there this year. And if that's not enough, Roger McGuinn of the Byrds is also set to pop in for a jam, virtually guaranteeing a version of Tambourine Man is going to be played. And it's all for a good cause. Tickets are $25. You can still get them online, but they're going fast. And it's going to benefit scholarships for graduate students in library and information studies. My ALA preview also includes a talk with Jonathan Band, who you know very well, Chris, is the library community's go-to lawyer and who writes most of their briefs. You know, we talk a lot about lawsuits and legal cases here on this show, and as you know, we often talk about much of the work that John Band does. He writes many of the briefs for the ALA and for other library organizations. You know, and what's interesting that we talked about is that there's always been natural tension between libraries and publishers, but in recent years, that tension has really gone from sort of around the edges of what libraries do right to the very heart of libraries' existence, from challenges to the doctrine of first sale and to fair use. So you'll want to check out that conversation and some of the things that Jonathan has to say about that. Also in the package, we have a column from Nancy Pearl, an interview with incoming President Maureen Sullivan, and there's a great feature on serving high-low readers. That is, those young readers with a high interest in reading but low skills. And it's truly amazing what the industry is doing to serve this community, and it really highlights the common cause of libraries and publishers, and that is to preach the gospel of reading. So whether or not you're going to make it to Anaheim, you'll want to check out Monday's issue. And if you're still on the fence, it's not too late. Come join us in the land of Disney.
Well, you know, Andrew, if I know you well, and I think I know you not too badly, you would be itching to get up on stage with the Rock Bottom Remainders there. That does sound like a heck of a lineup, including Roger McGuinn of the Byrds. Wow.
Hey, it could happen.
It could, yeah. Bring your guitar. Anyway, Andrew Albanese, PW's Features Editor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure.
And we want to turn now to Rose Fox, PW Reviews Editor, who blogs at Genreville. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Rose.
Thank you, Chris. And like everybody else, I also have a 50 Shades story, but this is sort of the opposite of somebody downloading it anonymously to their Kindle. I heard of a woman who walked into a bookstore and asked the clerk, do you carry 50 Shades of Grey? And the clerk looked around and looked at the books nearby and looked at the decor and said, I don't know if you've noticed, ma'am, but this is a children's bookstore.
Well,
and apparently the woman hadn't noticed at all. She just assumed that every bookstore everywhere would have it, alphabets on the wall notwithstanding.
Or maybe she just didn't know what the book was really all about. We'll have to get back to her and find out. But listen, Rose, so you've got lots of books coming up this week. In fiction, a writer that we hear a great deal about has a new novel.
Yeah, Michael Chabon has Telegraph Avenue is his new novel, and virtuosity is the word most commonly associated with Chabon. And if his latest novel is at first glance less conceptual than its predecessors, like the Yiddish Policeman's Union, the sentences are no less remarkable. It's set during the Bush and Kerry election in the author's hometown of Berkeley, California, and it centers around a vintage record store. So all the elements of a socially progressive contemporary novel are in place, but his hyper-retro style does perhaps wear out its welcome. We also have a strong review of Scott Lasser's quietly moving new novel, Say Nice Things About Detroit, in which the heyday, the riots, and the collapse of Detroit have already happened, and the city is quietly dying. A man returns to the city to care for his sick mother and is quickly reintroduced to the racial tensions that he thought he'd left behind. This is a restrained portrait of Detroit, and our reviewer says it evokes real pathos. In mystery and thriller, Elmore Leonard fans will welcome two novels that rival Leonard at his best. We have Brad Smith's Crow's Landing, in which an upstate New York farmer is in trouble after pulling a metal cylinder that may contain 100 pounds of Colombian cocaine out of the Hudson River. And Lou Burney's Whiplash River, in which an ex-con who used to be a getaway driver for the Armenian Mafia in Southern California wants to go straight, but running a restaurant quickly leads into trouble, too. And there's a mystery Q&A with James Lee Burke, who's the author of Creole Bell. He says that he stole liberally from Greek myths, including Proteus rising from the sea and the legend of Prometheus. And he says, I'm also guilty often of stealing from the Bible. So I guess that follows the rule that if you're going to steal, steal from the best.
That's right. What have we got in science fiction this week?
We have a great collection by Nina Kariki Hoffman. This is Permeable Borders. A lot of people have been waiting quite a while for this. She's had a tremendous career over the past 30 years and is really at her best with short fiction. Our reviewer says that these are perfect gem-like stories that would complement any library. We also cover Auroria by Tim Westover. This is a Baroque alternate history about America's first gold rush in the titular small Georgia town. Now, I had never known that there was a gold rush in Georgia, so this is all very educational for me. But in addition to talking about the realities of a gold rush in Georgia, Westover describes Auroria as a town of spirits and importance, including potatoes with starchy fangs, love that phrase, and snowball hens that lay ice cream eggs.
Well, you know, snowball hens that lay ice cream eggs leads us to a rather interesting and somewhat tasty title in romance.
Yeah, there's been a lot of foodie romance going around lately. This is part of the trend. It's a book called Luscious, the third in a series by Amanda Usun. And in this title, a recently divorced chef goes home to Verona, Italy, where her parents try to hook her up with the cook at their inn. But she has other ideas, like her divorce attorney, who followed her to Verona on the very thin pretext of business. And our reviewer says this dish is mighty tasty, though the presentation could use a little polish. We have an audiobook section this week. We cover 8 by Dustin Lance Blagg. That's read by a full cast, recorded in front of a live audience in Los Angeles. It's an all-star production, and it's Blagg's play that chronicles the efforts of the American Federation for Equal Rights to overturn Proposition 8, the state constitutional amendment that eliminated the rights of same-sex couples to marry in California. Our reviewer says it is educational, affecting, funny, and absolutely gripping, and that this important book should be required listening for all Americans. We also have a memoir, Let's Pretend This Never Happened, by Jenny Lawson. She's better known as The Bloggess. She has a tremendously popular blog, and in this memoir she describes her childhood in Texas, her experiences with marriage and motherhood, and how she became a sort of mature adult. She also recounts the anecdotes that you mentioned earlier in your introduction, her first acid trip when her husband proposed marriage and she thought he was trying to kill her. And she touches on some serious topics, such as her series of miscarriages and her severe anxiety disorder, and she softens her delivery to fit the material. And she reads her own book here, so her performance seems more like stand-up comedy than traditional narration, making this audiobook both entertaining and engaging. In nonfiction, we have a big review of the new book by Nicholson Baker. It's a diverse collection of essays called The Way the World Works, and it spans 15 years. It's gorgeous prose that also poses important questions about our era of digital readership. And while his musings on video games and the neighborhood trash dump are memorable, the collection's real value lies in its essays on reading. So if you're the sort of book fan who likes books about books and books about people who like books, this is one for you. In the children's section, we've got A Preponderance of Monsters in Music. We have picture books about a monster who's overly attached to his unruly head of hair. That's Bethany Barton's This Monster Need a Haircut. And another monster who isn't as nasty as he used to be in Tiffany Strelitz-Haber's The Monster Who Lost His Mean. We also have a huge two-page roundup of picture book sequels, which includes reviews of Chris Gall's Revenge of the Dino Trucks, Roz Chass' Marco Goes to School, and Minnie Gray's Traction Man and the Beach Odyssey. On the fiction side, we've got a trio of young adult novels about music-loving teenagers, Janet Tajian's For What It's Worth, Mary Amato's Guitar Notes, and Ed Bryant's I Am Not the Walrus. We've also got a review of the much-anticipated collaboration between Justine Larbalestier and Sarah Rees-Brennan, Team Human, which is about a teenage girl who is actively trying to disrupt her best friend's growing romance with a vampire. It's funny, smart stuff, and the buzz for that has gone way outside the young adult world. I very rarely get to indulge in YA, but I've been waiting on tenterhooks for this one like everyone else.
A great title, Team Human. And in the annex, a New York Times writer goes island hopping.
Yeah, the book is called Island Practice, Cobblestone Rash, Underground Tom, and Other Adventures of a Nantucket Doctor. The author is New York Times health writer Pam Bellick, and she tells the inspiring and entertaining story of Dr. Timothy Lepore, an eccentric jack-of-all-trades practicing in Nantucket. He's a surgeon, physician, psychiatrist, and even sometimes a veterinarian, and he's got a cache of 200 guns that are booby-trapped with tear gas. And she details some of his remarkable cases and his decidedly unique methods of diagnosing and treating his patients. It's a quick, fun, and engaging read. Also on the Annex, we review what will likely be the last collection of nonfiction from postmodern novelist John Barth. It's called Final Fridays, Essays, Lectures, Tributes, and Other Nonfiction, 1995 to 2012. And these are essays on topics as diverse as colonial American history, Christian exegesis, the rise of electronic literature, Borges, Calvino, and Scheherazade. And it's written in welcoming and ebullient prose. It's a stellar addition, or perhaps final cap, on Barth's body of work. And finally, our pick of the week is from nonfiction this week, a new memoir, Aftermath, on marriage and separation, from British novelist and memoirist Rachel Cusk, who also wrote A Life's Work. And it lays bare divorce's impact on herself and her family. Writing in cerebral and unsentimental prose, Cusk reveals her insights about gender roles, feminism, motherhood, and religion, interspersed with stories within stories, vivid scenes from her life, and piercing observations. And she musters her considerable literary powers to mine a complex terrain filled with heartbreak and doubt.
Well, Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor, blogs at Germanville, thanks for your review of the reviews.
Oh, you're very welcome, Chris.
And we should say that Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as now images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.